Hello and welcome to a new season of Dr. Med KI, a collaborative learning initiative between the AI Campus and the Charité Universitätsmedizin Berlin. My name is Marina Lex and I'm a PhD student at Professor Dr. Kerstin Ritter's research group at Charité. In today's episode, we will uncover how AI is transforming surgery, both now and in the future. I'm excited to welcome Professor Uzanan Mireles. He's a vice chairman of innovation at Duke University School of Medicine's Department of Surgery and a leader of the renowned Surgical AI and Innovation Laboratory. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Marina. Thank you very much. And good morning and good afternoon to everybody. It's a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Could you briefly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Absolutely. So my name is Uzanan Mireles. Sometimes I go by Oz. And I am a surgeon. I'm a bariatric and minimally invasive surgeon. And also I do flexible endoscopy. I am the vice chairman of innovation for the Department of Surgery at Duke University. I'm also the surgical director of Duke AI Health. And I'm the director of sales, the Surgical Artificial Intelligence and Innovation Laboratory. Another hat that I have is I am the chair of the SAGES AI committee for the technical people. SAGES is the largest minimally invasive surgical society in the world for about 7,000 surgeons. I am originally from São Paulo, Brazil. Then I did my medical school in São Paulo, moved to the United States where I did my residency at Michigan State. I did my research fellowship at Johns Hopkins. I did my clinical fellowship at UC San Diego in California. And then I moved to Mass General Hospital in Boston, one of the Harvard-affiliated teaching hospitals. And I spent 13 years there until then I just moved to Duke 1 year ago. One of my major goals is to make surgical AI scalable, sustainable, and to democratize knowledge, access, lowering costs, and improve outcomes.
You've had an impressive journey to becoming a leading innovator in AI for surgery. Could you share how it all began and what brought you to your current research? Which hurdles did you face?
Yeah, of course. So every time somebody has an idea or has like an aim in life, it comes from perhaps some pains or hardship that you face through your career, right? For me, it was the fact that working in a world-class hospital such as the Massachusetts General Hospital, we were still getting a lot of transfers from outside hospital. And then much of that was because those surgeons lacked the technique, but it was because of lack of cognitive knowledge. And what I mean is that we tend to become super specialized in surgery. And much of the time, we're going to go practice just bariatric surgery or just colorectal surgery. And some people go into general surgery. And but the patients have the same needs independent of which regions they were. So the thought was, if we could somehow do some telementoring to those surgeons on those remote areas, you will prevent those patients to be transferred or like would decrease complications.
So that's really interesting for our listeners to know what telementoring means. Telementoring in surgery is when an expert surgeon helps guide a less experienced one during an operation using video calls or other technology so they can learn and improve even if they aren't in the same room. How did you accomplish the telementoring task?
So we started this experiment using the Google Glass. And it was quite interesting in the beginning, but we found more shortcomings of the device than actually any benefits. Other than the benefits was really making us to think outside the box. The problem was, and there was a paper published on this, that the point of view for the Google Glass was different than the point of view from the surgeon. The battery wasn't lasting, was like overheating, the sound wasn't perfect. So it was not ideal. But then what we came across was that being a minimally invasive surgeon, what does it mean for the people who are not in the medical field, as we rely on making small incisions on the abdomen or on the chest. We put ports, we put instruments, we put camera, and then we look in the monitor. And the monitor, what I'm seeing, my assistant is seeing, and we could actually do this within several kilometers or miles, there will be the same type of view that the other person is going to have. So therefore, if we could do that, we could actually then start reaching all those areas. Imagine that if those specialists have to be tutoring the surgeons with less skills and cognitive knowledge, I'm saying, you're going to take, the entire time of the surgeon, right? So that's not expendable. Furthermore, more recently, the American Board of Surgeons are going to put in video-based assessment as one of their core, targets for surgeons who graduate, right? So imagine also for people to review all those videos. It's going to be hard, right? You don't have enough manpower for that. So starting with a partnership with MIT, which is just across the river of Mass General, we just start exploring other types of technologies. And we came across back in 2017 on some techniques in computer vision that could allow segmentation of surgical video. Back then, they were not using this to segment surgical video. They're using just to autonomous vehicles, movies, and things like that. So the partnership was quite natural between us from Mass General and our collaborators from MIT, from CSAIL, which was led by Daniela Russ, Guy Rosman, and back then, Mikhail Volkov, one of their PhDs. And we successfully were able to segment a video of laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy, which means we are removing part of the stomach to cure obesity and all laparoscopically. And we were able to train the machine with a small amount of videos. And the machine was able to then start making predictions about that segmentation of the video with high accuracy. Just to remind, a video is a sequence of images over time, right? So we have the spatial features, and then we also have the temporal features, right? And then if we are able to deconstruct the surgical procedure in all those smaller elements, once we put them together, we could actually do transfer learning from one procedure to another, like we do in life, right? If I'm an intern in surgery, and if I'm doing, let's say, a laparoscopic appendectomy to remove the appendix because it's inflamed, I see that the organ is inflamed. Next time I'm going to do the first time a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, removing the gallbladder, my brain already going to transfer the knowledge that I acquire of inflammation from one organ to the other, right? So that's what we're trying to do with AI in a surgical AI.
So you've worked on AI models that support surgeons in real time during surgery. I would like to get into more detail about it. So can you state again what type of information is exactly provided to the models, and then what benefits do they bring to the operating room?
Yeah, so thanks for the question. First of all, as just a disclosure that's important for people to understand, at the moment, there is no surgical AI model available for surgery that has been approved by the FDA or, the European Commission. There are, however, like, for example, polyp detectors, like, for example, they are being approved in many companies. They have already their special applications where what they do is when you are doing a colonoscopy or, let's say, an upper endoscopy, but mainly colonoscopy, if there is a polyp, the machine will create a bounding box around it and gonna make a classification of that polyp. Like, for example, this is likely malignant, this is not malignant, so on and so forth. Nothing that the endoscopist will not be doing. So it doesn't actually really alter that much what's happening. There is several studies showing that it can increase polyp detection, but others say that also increases a polyp extraction. And when you look at pathology, not necessarily those polyps were needed to be, extracted. So, but that's the beginning, the birth of this type of technology. And that's the thing you see first on AI for surgery or flexible endoscopy. The experimental part for intra-abdominal, that's what I think common the most because I'm an abdominal surgeon. What can be done? What's possible? One, if you look about on the operational efficiency portion, right? You can predict how long the surgery is going to take. That prediction can change over time if, let's say, a complication happens or a alter anatomy is found, right? So the machine can be changed at that. Why is that important? Because if this is transmitted to the control center of a anesthesia room in a hospital, they can start predicting how long that room is going to be utilized, and therefore assigning different rooms to others. And then the other thing that the system can do is can predict the resources. For example, if you believe that the patient is bleeding more than it should, or if there is a potential of, let's say, bleeding or in need of a different instrumentation, the machine can start predicting and like already pre-ordering those resources to come to the OR. The machine can also predict the team, right? We will know who is operating, because when we, for the non-medical people here, when we go to the operating room, you have the surgical team, which is the surgeon and the assistants. You have the anesthesia team, and then you have the auxiliary team, which are the staffs, which are non-MDs, which they help us with the instrumentation, with opening devices, and so on and so forth. And if you work with the same team every day, that's perfect, right? So everybody knows each other, don't even need to speak. But that's not reality. And sometimes you work with somebody who never worked before, and the person doesn't know, understand the resource that you need. So then what happened is the system could start prompting them about what to do next, or even sometimes recommending to replace one of the person on that team that's not expert enough if that procedure start becoming more complicated. So to prevent any potential mistakes during this case. The system can also do post hoc evaluation about the resource utilization. So it can start making predictions about, this type of equipment I'm not really using, so just opening unnecessarily, or this equipment is needed more. Could talk to the revenue management of the hospital, it can be ordering more. From this is like an operational efficiency portion. Post hoc, also, the system could be used, the surgical video, to generate an operative report. Because normally what we do, we just type it, or we just dictate it, or we use a template. But a system could generate the most, crystal clear, honest operative report, because it's just translating what happened in the video to the paper. Of course, you can adjust the degrees of granularity of that. The system can also do the billing for us, because based on what happened in the video, let's say, for example, I remove a gallbladder and I did an intraoperative cholangiogram. So all of that are billable events, and the system can do that for us as well. And also the system could be communicating with family members, like the surgeon has finished, everything went okay, your surgeon going to be calling you later. So what does this do immediately right there is it buy us time. And time for us is so important. Because of that, we can spend more time with our patients, we can spend more time with our families or doing research or whatever is productive other than just documentation. What I think is going to happen next would be the interoperative guidance. You'll be the day that all this knowledge that's being gathered by all the surgeons in the world, sharing their videos to build this platform. We call this a computational collective surgical consciousness. You'll be like a super fancy ways guiding us to surgery. So in other words, would be, if somebody is doing a procedure that and a person have never faced this anatomy challenge before, or something has happened, the system can prevent the complication to occur, or can help the surgeon to get out of the complication, right? It goes back to the example I talk about, the surgeons from the remote areas, that they lack the cognitive knowledge, but they have the technical skills. Suddenly they're doing an operation, say, well, I haven't done this in a while, but I can transfer like much of my knowledge from other procedures to this. I just need to know what to do, right? So instead of having that human doing the telementoring aspect of it, you have in the real time that collective consciousness guiding you through the case, right? And more we do, better it gets. If it's correct or like it was a mistake, the machine learns from that. So that's what I think. And with that, just imagine that the sky's the limit what we can do with that.
I assume that these are several models that are used to predict. Can you take one model as an example and explain which type of AI model was used?
Yeah, so again, I'm not a technical person, and I have to go back to the paper to tell exactly which AI model was, and I'm happy to share with you. But I can tell you, for example, we have used like LLMs, you know, what else? Convolutional neural networks, neural graph networks, to do different aspects of the surgery. And there is always like a combination of like, let's say LLM or LSTM, that gives the output. But for example, and like I said, I cannot quote exactly which one was done on each, but our papers are all published in archives and also, in other sources such as surgical endoscopy and annals of surgery. But one of the papers was super interesting. Was the first author was Dr. Ward, and he was one of our clinical fellows. He was using a Parkland formula scale to teach the machine to think like the surgeon would. What is the Parkland formula for laparoscopic cholecystectomy? When the gallbladder gets inflamed, there is different levels of inflammation. There is a minor inflammation up to severe inflammation. And this has been graded and validated in people called the Parkland scale, right? So using the Parkland scale, we taught the system how to grade those gallbladders inflammation. But so as soon as we had the camera go inside the abdomen, the camera will look at the gallbladder. And you're gonna say, the system gonna say, oh, that's the degree of inflammation. The interesting about that is that they're correlated with the length of the operation. And also we were able to cluster some different surgeons with different techniques. And the likelihood that there will be an injury to the wall of the gallbladder based on the inflammation. All of this we experienced surgeons know because we've been doing this over and over. Look, oh, this gallbladder is inflamed. This case is not going to last 30 minutes. It's going to be a 2-hour case, you know, and give me a bigger suction because there was a chance that I'm going to be injuring the wall and get some stones to suction. So this is, of course, makes absolute sense. But interesting enough, we didn't get to that level to tell the machine all of this. We're just like we're grading and then as we moved the experiment, we saw that those gradings were correlating with those findings during the operation. It didn't correlate with injury to the common bile duct or achieving the critical view of safety. And just the ones here on the call who are not surgeons, the critical view of safety during a laparoscopic cholecystectomy means that you have achieved a visual cue during the operation where only two structures are going to the gallbladder, the cystic artery and the cystic duct, which are the ones that we want to clip and cut to remove the gallbladder. If you achieve that view, the likelihood of no complications to occur to the biliary tree is extremely high. And the likelihood of the patient to be going home the same day as a few hours is extremely high. However, if you don't find that, there is a possibility that you may be injuring ducts that you didn't want to injure. So that's why that's important. And that's what also goes back again to the CVS challenge, which was the critical view of safety challenge, where we got more than 1,000 videos across the globe. And then we annotated them and released them for a competition. And then was presented at MIKAI so people to get the highest accuracy of the CVS detection.
Thank you. That's a very practical insight. When do you feel like looking into the future that your system will be FDA approved? Like, is there a timeline you're aiming for?
Not really. And I don't think it's going to be one single system. It's going to be perhaps a combination of models working together. I know that many of those strategic companies, when I mean strategic, like Johnson & Johnson, Medtronic, Olympus, Intuitive Surgical, they are working on this. The challenge about getting approval from the FDA is that which level of approval do you want, right? You want to just to give an information and that information, the surgeon still have to agree or disagree. Or do you want to be the point that your information is so strong that a disagreement might be something that might need to be challenged? And for you to get to that point, it costs a lot of money, a lot of training, a lot of time. And if you think about that, those AI models, they get obsolete very quickly. I don't think we will be seeing one of those in the next few years, just because imagine you could actually go through all the trouble and time of getting something approved through FDA. And then as soon as you get approved, like 2 months later, another model is better than yours. So I think that the economical aspect is going to be playing a role on that. So I think what the applications are going to be seeing will be ones that does not need major approval from the FDA. In other words, it's like we're not directly going to be influencing the treatment of the patient. We're going to see a lot of the operational efficiency coming up, like the billing, the op reports, and things like that. But within 5 years, after we start seeing other AI models playing a role within healthcare, I think small companies, startups, going to start challenging this paradigm and start putting something out. Our personal goal at the beginning is not to create a model to get FDA approved and to be used in patients. Our goal is more holistic. We want to enable developers. We want to enable data generators to interact to each other to develop those models. And then we want them to benchmark those models internally within the platform. And of course, then when you know that you are very good in accuracy compared to the others, then you'll be more reasonable, you as a company, to say, hey, I think I should actually go through the FDA approval at this point.
I'd like to conclude our discussion on AI models that assist surgeons in real time during surgeries. In the next episode, we will explore the future applications of AI in surgery with you and discuss whether visions of robots and surgical procedures can become reality.